Well, the thing about a spiral is that if you follow it inward, it just keeps going forever. It just gets tighter and tighter, and it never actually ends. And that's kind of how Aza experiences her thoughts. Once she's in it, it feels like she's not wrong. That's really terrifying. It's also really isolating for her because she struggles to be able to describe it with language. She struggles for the words that that would help other people understand what she's going through.
Season's greetings, Misfits. On today's episode, we will be discussing Turtles All the Way Down by John Green, which, by the way, is about to become a movie, so you are getting in on the ground floor. But first, it's the second part of our first annual holiday gift guide, full of bookish gifts for everyone you know and love. Then, we are digging into Turtles All the Way Down. We'll be talking about everything from friendships to teenage romance to mental illness. So, if mental illness is a trigger for you, be aware. Oh, yeah, and there are a bunch of spoilers in this episode, but we think that you're going to love it whether you've read the book or not. So go ahead and grab a Dr. Pepper, wash your hands really, really well, cuddle up with your favorite Chewbacca fanfiction, and let's get this party started. Hi, this is Maria Blackheart, and welcome to the Misfit Book Club, a podcast for readers, weirdos, obsessives, normals, scribbling women, nerd fighters, loons, screwballs, and every type of bookish person in between. This is episode 10, and I'm joined by my co-host, Pixie Burger.
Hey, Turtle.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you doing, Maria?
Honestly, I am in a shameful place. I am in my closet sitting on a pile of dirty laundry. We are at a new low.
Well, I normally am in the closet, but today I got a new couch, which is exciting because I've been living in this house for several months without a couch or a chair. Just sit in.
What have you been sitting on?
I do have one chair in my like library office. But when I eat dinner, I've literally been eating takeout dinner on the floor. So this is a real big step for me. So it arrived today. They unpacked it and I sat down on it and I was like, well, this is not the most comfortable couch ever. But I leaned back and realized that it is the perfect reading couch. Like it gives me just enough support in the back, but it's uncomfortable enough that I'm not going to just like fall asleep immediately. So I've been sitting on my couch for like 10 hours. And so I'm on the couch instead of in the closet.
I have this mental image of you, Tiny Tim style, sitting in the middle of a living room, eating out of a styrofoam container on this tiny little rickety chair.
I didn't even have a rickety chair. Like, I was just straight up eating on the floor. It was bad. But, you know, I have a house. I have a roof over my head, so it's fine. And now I have a couch.
Yay. Wonderful couch. I think you should tell people about your reading porch.
I do have a reading porch. It also has no furniture on it. Mm-hmm. And it looks out over my yard and my garden. And it has these great like windows that are adjustable. And it is just going to be fantastic.
In the springtime, will you post pictures of it to Instagram?
I will. It was made for reading. Basically, I bought the house because of that reading porch.
That's what bookworms do, though, is we buy houses for our books, not for us.
Books take up approximately 80% of my house. So yeah, that's true.
I haven't unpacked all my books yet. And we've been here almost a year. It's tragic.
But it's a dilemma. It's a bookworm dilemma. We've all got too many.
I mean, there are worse problems to have. Mm-hmm. We could be druggies, I suppose.
Yeah. We could have too few books. That would also be a really sad problem. But speaking of books, it is the holidays. And we, in our last episode, had a gift guide.
Wait. I got to tell you how I wrecked my cars.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I should have just let it keep going. I got to get this off my chest, honestly. So my husband has a pretty demanding job. And sometimes when things get crazy, he has to work late. He'd been working like late for 2 weeks. And I'm talking about getting home at like 9 or 10 at night. So I'd been out and I got home and I needed to change clothes because I had this volunteer meeting I needed to be at. And in the interest of time, I decided to park in the middle of our garage.
So I'm running around like a crazy person. And all of a sudden my husband gets home and he's like, hey, how are you? And I was like, oh gosh, I'm like, I gotta go. I'm sorry. And he was like, okay, well, I'm parked in the driveway. Don't hit my car. And I was like, okay.
No.
So I've got like a handful of papers. I jump into my car and I'm like plugging in my phone and I open the garage door and I didn't realize where he was parked because clearly I wasn't looking like I needed to. And I kind of start backing out of the garage and crunch right into the car.
Oh no, Maria.
Not only am I in a worst case scenario where you have hit your own vehicle, now I have to go inside and fess up to doing the thing I was told specifically not to do.
Oh no. How bad was it?
Well, my husband's car has some scuffs on it, but like the bumper of my car is definitely crunched.
Oh no.
Yeah. So now,
ugh.
Merry Christmas to us.
You get some body work done, which is never cheap.
And I'm ashamed.
I think you win this week. Like, I was really ashamed about sitting on the couch for 10 hours, but you did wreck two cars in one evening. So you win.
Well, thanks for making me feel better, Pixie. Podcast over. So anyway, now we both have car accident stories. You wrecked a U-Haul and a pylon, and mm-hmm. I slammed both our cars together in the driveway.
Yeah.
Banner 2017.
I mean, I'm a pretty good driver most of the time, and so are you. It's just been a really shitty year. Let's just call it what it is. Like,
yes,
our minds are elsewhere. It's the holidays, which Marie and I were talking earlier, and we're not always like super pro holiday. Because there's a lot of stuff and drama that goes on around holidays.
And guilt.
Guilt, yes. Expectation. Putting it all out there, Misfits. We're a couple of Scrooges.
It's been kind of a rough one.
It has.
But I'm glad I'm here with you.
Same. I mean, I feel like the podcast in general is a joyful event for me. So that's, you know, this is a good turn, right?
It is.
In our last episode, we had a gift guide where we gave some specific book recommendations for different readers in your life. We also gave you the challenge of reaching out to us on social media and saying, hey, help me pick a book for some specific family member or friend that needs a book. I am a total capitalist when it comes to books. Spend all your money on books. So yeah, this is part two of the gift guide.
All right. So we all know that we love books, but we also love book-related items. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, bookish candles. Are you a candle person?
I do like a nice candle. I do. Yes.
I'm terrified of fire. So... So I grew up in the desert where fire was literally the scariest thing in the whole world because the whole city would go up like a tinderbox.
Oh, no. Right.
The house I grew up in was built in the 1970s. It had a fireplace for some reason, but like the only thing you could put in the fireplace were like candles. I have such a healthy fear of fire that my new house has a fireplace that I am terrified of. So when it turns on, I just like sit there and watch it. So currently I'm using candles to like acclimate myself to fire.
My gosh. I'm like crying because that is so sad.
Anyway, bookish candles.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite are the Patty Wax Library candles. They're soy based.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're vegan, but I would bet they're vegan. And they are all themed around authors. So they have like Jane Austen, Oscar Wilde, Leo Tolstoy, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and they smell fantastic. I have the Jane Austen one and I really like it.
Does it smell like Jane Austen?
I imagine people back then smelled a lot like sweat.
Yeah, I don't think they probably smelled good. I'm just kidding.
It has a real like floral scent that I like personally. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say one of my coworkers brought in one of these the other day. She bought it for a gift for another coworker and I was pleasantly surprised. Yeah, that's a good rec. And I've bought candles without smelling them before online. So having a person actually say like, oh, yes, this smells really good, I think means a lot because that's like a thing you can't really experience over the internet, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay. So also, Story Arts, Story, S-T-O-R-I, arts.com. They sell these fantastic bookish scarves. Mm-hmm. So it's like Alice in Wonderland, like printed on this super soft scarf. That's my second gift recommendation. They have like fingerless gloves.
Ooh.
And I bought a pair of those for one of my friends, and they were really soft and good quality. And
I've got one. I've ordered from them several times. Obvious State. They have beautiful prints. You have sent me postcards designed by Obvious State. They make beautiful art prints, but they also have bookmarks, postcards, stationery, mugs, beautiful tote bags that feature quotations from famous poets, writers. They're very classy. So I would check them out for sure if you want to buy a nice tote bag. Who doesn't love a tote bag?
If you don't love tote bags, get out. They're the best things ever.
Go home.
Oh, kind of along those lines, outofprint.com.
Mm-hmm.
Love them. They make these posters that are the full text of your favorite books.
Yeah. They have great items at Out of Print.
They also have like banned book socks, which are fantastic. And they also have wonderful totes of library punch cards. Not that any of you youngsters know what that is, but, you know, for us olds, that's pretty exciting. And our last bookish recommendation is a book subscription box. Have you had one?
I have had one. I am a member of the Book of the Month Club, and I've given Book of the Month as a gift, and it was well received. It's nice because you are giving the gift of a book, but you aren't having the job of choosing a book for someone. They get to choose what they want to receive. So, and they can skip a month for however many months you give them. They can postpone if they don't like any of the options. So
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of others that I have either tried or know someone who's tried them. The Book Riot Box, it's quarterly, so you get four a year. And it's full of books and bookish delights. Fairy Loot is more YA geared. And that is really fun because all of their books are UK editions. I got Caraval by Stephanie Garber that way.
Yeah.
And I've done Owlcrate. And Owlcrate is really fun because you can buy it by the box. So you can just buy one and have it delivered. And they also, if they have overstock from previous months, you can buy those. So that might be kind of a fun, cost-effective way to get somebody a really cool bookish box.
Yeah, that's great.
And so if you have any bookish gift recommendations, share them. You can tweet them to us and we'll retweet them to everybody. You can post them on our Instagram and we would love to see what you love to give.
Definitely. The trick I've said with, you know, buying for book lovers is you want to get them something thoughtful, but you may not know what books they already have. So those are all some really good options for people that you're like, oh, I know this bookish person, but I, you know, they have a lot of books.
Speaking of books that we have and love,
what
if we jump into Turtles All the Way Down?
I'm super ready. I mean, I feel like we're probably going to have some spirals and those thought spirals are going to go a little bit crazy in this conversation, but I'm ready.
Let's do it. Okay, so Turtles All the Way Down by John Green, literally the hottest book. What did you think?
So I'll be honest, I was a bit nervous to read this book. Because number one, The Fault in Our Stars was such a huge hit that it's hard to live up to that sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think authors fret maybe too much about it and they just try to recreate the same thing just better. And a lot of the time it doesn't work. So I was nervous that that was what was going to happen here. But I was pleasantly surprised because that is not what happened at all. This is a completely different story. It's a very different book in good ways for sure. So yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. It was hard to read at moments for me, but really rewarding, I think. How about you?
I'm really conflicted. Mm-hmm. So this is my first John Green book, but I sort of knew what I was getting into. I have more familiarity with John Green as a YouTube personality than I do as an author. So I like him, like, as a person, or at least as a personality. And so in some ways, it's hard for me to be objective about the book. Because I like him. And I'm afraid because I don't want people to kill me on the internet.
No one can kill you if they don't know who you are, which is the whole point of us being anonymous.
I actually have a quote from Matt Haig of The Guardian. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit long, but it kind of sums up my thoughts. Okay, he writes, "This is by no means a perfect novel. The mystery and love story and mental health aspects often feel compartmentalized, and it is 50 pages too long," which I don't know about that, but fine. "Aza can be a repetitive narrator. This may be appropriate for someone who suffers repetitive thoughts, but it can make the reading experience frustrating. Some of the recurring mental illness metaphors couldn't have been hammered harder by Thor himself. It feels as though the illness as spiral idea occurs at least once a chapter, and there are more stargazy, sentimental big moments than at a Coldplay concert. But all this is overridden by the fact that where the author is good, he is very, very good." And that's a little harsher than what I would say, but it kind of sums up the way I felt about the book.
Okay, yeah.
Well, one, John Green is just a good writer.
Yes.
His use of language and the way he puts stuff together is just good, objectively. And I really liked the mental health aspects of the book, but there was stuff that I didn't think worked that well.
Mm-hmm.
I say this a lot. There are books that I think are good, important books, but that I don't know that I personally enjoyed reading.
Mm-hmm.
So a good example of that would be The Great Gatsby. Really, I've already gone all in, so I'm going to keep going all in, right?
Sure.
The Great Gatsby is 5 stars because of it's an important literary book. But if I were to rate like my enjoyment reading The Great Gatsby, I'm like at a 2.5. Does that make sense?
Totally. Absolutely.
I feel that way about Turtles All the Way Down. In terms of its level of importance as a book, and the way that it represents mental illness and how it represents mental illness, I would give it 4.5 stars. But if I had to rate like my experience with the book, I would be more at like 2.5 to 3 stars.
Mm-hmm. That's fair, I think. First of all, that blurb from The Guardian is pretty good. It makes some very good points. For me, the plot was definitely not as strong. I mean, there were moments that were really, really good, but other things that didn't come together as well. And yes, I don't disagree with the critique that sometimes the mental illness stuff was too much, but I also am reading it as an adult. And I'm trying to think of the intended audience of this book, which is teenagers who might need or want that point to be hammered in a little bit more than, say, a subtle critic for The Guardian might want. I see both sides of that.
And I do, too. And I think that's why I feel so conflicted about it, right? Like, I have so many competing feelings. And so this might be, like, a me problem. So, for example, like, I know I already said this, but Jurassic Park, when we read it, I was like, oh, I don't know that I'm going to like this, right?
Right.
And then, like, 50 pages in, I was like, this is so great, right? And I loved it so much more than I thought I would. And this is a book where I was like, I'm going to love this.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got to the end and I was like,
The romance was a bit unsatisfying for me in this book. The relationship between Aza and Davis was not all that compelling. They had some shared loss, and so I did feel like there was so much potential there, but that did not live up to the Fault in Our Stars for sure. So I would say that's true, which is not necessarily bad, but it's almost like maybe there was too much happening and that was the thing that just kind of got lost.
Yes, yes. I think you actually hit on it. That I felt like there was too much happening in this book. It was about mortality and philosophy and mental illness and romantic relationships and interpersonal relationships. And then there was this murder mystery story. And it was like, this is a lot to cram into a 194-page book.
Yeah, which to me, that's the thing with the quote that you mentioned from The Guardian, like 50 pages too long. Like, I don't think that's true at all. If anything, the stuff that was introduced didn't get as much as it probably deserved.
I 100% agree. Thank you for helping me articulate my thoughts about this book because I've been nervous. For someone who loves to talk, like I've had a really hard time figuring out how to explain the way that I feel about it.
Well, one of my favorite aspects was the relationship between Daisy and Aza. Okay, so Daisy and Aza are best friends. Daisy talks constantly. Aza doesn't talk very much, which was a really interesting protagonist situation, really. We are in her brain, and she has a very active mind, but as for dialogue, she really doesn't talk much. So I actually really loved that, but like their relationship was so complicated as two friends trying to relate to each other, even though it's so hard to understand where your even your best friend's brain is sometimes. And so I loved that storyline to the point where like I almost at times just wished like it was just the two of them trying to work out their friendship. And sure, that the rotating boyfriend like Michael can come in and out, but I got a lot out of that and wish there were more.
And even that is just so well done because it is so complicated. Right. But that's how people are.
Yeah. And for teenagers, you know, I think they do expect romance. There's mm-hmm. just that's just the expectation for young adult literature. So it's probably unreasonable for me to say like, oh, you should have just left this part out. Like it didn't do anything for me. Like in the scheme of things, that dynamic was much more interesting to me. Because even the shared loss that Davis and Aza had was not fully articulated.
So Davis loses his mom to an aneurysm. Ava loses her dad in a catastrophic medical event. It's mm-hmm. never really clear what happens. And that's how their orbits intersect. They both go to kind of grief camp.
Mm-hmm.
So, but going back to Daisy and Aza, I was reading some like Goodreads comments.
Ooh, yeah.
And there were a bunch of people that really hated Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
And sure. I was surprised by that.
Yeah.
I guess. So I understand Aza. Like, I understand that side of it. Like, being someone who's stuck in your own head. I have anxiety. Not the fire makes me nervous kind of anxiety, but like capital A anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that standpoint, I understand those moments where you can't be a good friend. It's hard to be a good anything. From that perspective, having Daisy in the book helped me understand other people's reaction since I'm very rarely in that position. Does that mm-hmm. make sense?
Absolutely. I understand why people are frustrated with Daisy or they dislike her. She does take up a lot of screen time, you know, in contrast, she is talking constantly. But, you know, the scene where they have their fight in the car, I think was like the best scene of the book because they both had really good critiques of each other. Right. Like, can you imagine, you know, being best friends with someone for years and not knowing any of their family members' names or their pet's name? Or, I mean, like things like that. Like,
no.
So I think Daisy's frustrations with Aza were legitimate. At the same time, I also have been in Daisy's situation, mm-hmm. having a friend with OCD and looking at that friend and being so extremely frustrated because, like, I knew she was being completely irrational. And she knew she was being completely irrational, and I didn't know how to deal with it. Like, how do you help people in that situation when you can't really understand what's going on in their head? So I see it. Like, I see both sides.
There's no good answer to that because everybody's experience with mental illness is different.
Absolutely.
You know, one person may say, I need you to call me out. And another person may say, I need you to ignore it. And another person may say, I need you to leave me alone. And another person may say, I need you to not leave me alone. Like,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it's so unique from moment to moment to moment. But I thought that relationship felt very, very authentic.
Same.
Actually, Daisy reminded me of a girl that I was friends in high school and then stopped being friends in high school with once she got a car. Because she no longer needed rides from me. And so when Daisy got her car, I was like, it's the beginning of the end.
No. Well, and the dynamic, I guess, that I did enjoy about them that was complimented by Davis and Noah was the class relationship between them. Like,
mm-hmm.
it's interesting to read about teenagers who aren't the girls on Gossip Girl, right? Like, mm-hmm. they have normal, middle, lower class income families, and they worry mm-hmm. about things like paying for college and buying cars and working outside of school. Like, those are real struggles that a lot of people don't want to read about or get to read about because it's not glamorous, right? So their lives, in contrast to Davis's, was pretty interesting.
Oh, man. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about mental illness in a second, but I kind of want to talk about like the money.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about it.
I'm not really sure either. To be honest, like,
it's important, we don't know.
Yeah, it's just like, I'm not really sure what the money was supposed to accomplish.
Yeah, I agree. Is it just sort of emphasizing class?
Yeah.
Is it a way to just sort of like show the kind of anxieties that affect lower and middle class people?
Mm-hmm.
But then I had to admit, when he just like gave them $100,000, I was like, what is this madness?
Money that he pulled out of the bottom of a cereal box.
Yes. And then they opened a bank account without their guardian signatures on the account. I was like, that's not legal. And then at the end of the book, Asa doesn't give the money back. Asa and Daisy split the $100,000, and basically Davis gives it to them so that they'll stop looking into the mystery of his dad's disappearance for the reward money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Daisy's like, dude, this money is going to change my family's life. I'm not looking back on it. But the complicating factor is Davis and Noah are going to lose everything. All the money has been given to a lizard. Just even saying that out loud, I don't even. Okay.
Yeah.
This makes it sound like I myself have done drugs. I have not. $1 billion going to a lizard. There mm-hmm. you have it. So, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the book, when in fact the boys have lost everything, Asa doesn't give him his money back.
Did you think she would?
Yes, I did actually.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she would be like, hey, you know, you don't have the money you need anymore. This was given to me. I haven't touched it. Like, you should have it back. I thought it was going to be a moment about Davis had worried about purchasing her affection, and she was going to give it back to him to kind of show the authenticity of that short relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But she's like, bye, I'm going to keep this $50,000. Hope it works out for you. And I mean, it wasn't quite like that, but she was just like, we're not talking. Like, this is my money. This is a good question. What would you have done? So you have been given $50,000 in hush money. Do you keep it?
I mean, probably. But at the same time, like, that would probably end my communication with that person. I don't know. That whole transaction was just very bizarre. I don't know.
I like to think I would have been like, no. I can't take. Well, I probably would have been like, no, I can't take your money because like this man is going to get investigated for fraud. And if I have this money, there's no amount of legal documents that's going to keep me from going to prison. And I don't want to go to prison for laundering $50,000.
Well, let's be real. Teenagers are not going to think that far. They're just going to take the money and go. But if anything, I guess the money just proved that there was a difference between them all. Right. And yeah. It set up this system of, I guess, a hierarchy, because even mm-hmm. after the money, you know, the girls had their share of it, they had fights over how it was going to be used. Asa was judgmental, supposedly, toward Daisy for buying a computer and buying a car with her money. Whereas Daisy was like, well, you can't say anything because you already have a car and you already have a computer. And I live in a shitty apartment with my family. Like, so she even sees herself as like the lowest of the low on this financial hierarchy.
I mean, I've got to admit, I sort of saw it from Asa's perspective. It's like, girl, you need to get a college degree and get out.
Right. You know, from that standpoint, the money was an interesting plot point. But otherwise, it was an odd one.
Yeah, I think so, too. Although I would like $1 billion, even if that meant that I had to have a weird lizard compound in the middle of my giant swimming pool. I'd deal with it.
Seriously. This book did include one of my absolute favorite tropes, which is adults that are completely worthless to their children.
Oh, that's your favorite trope?
It's a trope that I adore. Like, I also love parents who are super, super wonderful and loving, which is what we found in The Hate U Give. But then I also love a parent who is not just absent, but completely worthless. Like, badly behaved parents and adults. I live for that as well. So, yeah, Davis's dad is definitely just such a waste.
Absolutely.
What a nightmare to have that guy as your dad.
Who cares about the money at that point? This guy's a total dillweed.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. Is this why you love The Real Housewives so much, Pixie?
The Real Housewives are terrible mothers, mostly. Not all, but a lot of them are awful. And then you see their kids on television and you are amazed at how they're actually functional human beings. It's really a mystery.
I thought the eccentricity was like hysterical. Mm-hmm. Like there's this lizard and it ages real slowly. And they called it something else in the book.
The Tuatara.
Tuatara. And they're like, this is our resident zoologist. And I was like, it was one of those moments where I was like, what is happening? But it was so entirely entertaining. Mm-hmm. John Green does such a good job of getting into the head of a teenager because that's exactly what teenagers would think money is.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? Our own movie room, all the video games, a giant house, a lady to cook our food, the coolest animals, mm-hmm. and rich people like famous paintings. So paintings everywhere.
Right. Well, and the lizard, you know, the lizard is this grand investment, supposedly, that the dad has made, and he's going to leave everything he has to this lizard instead of his own children, okay? But the whole idea is that the lizard supposedly is going to open up the world of science and basically save everyone from death, right? Like, this is the legacy that he wants to leave behind, which in so many ways is really selfish. Right. Like, I just want to be famous for having done this. And so I'm going to leave all my money to a lizard. Like, it's just insane.
I don't know.
And the irony that, you know, the dad runs off and dies in a sewer.
Yep.
In spite of all of this, like trying to avoid death, he winds up here. Couldn't be more shameful.
It's a metaphor.
Yes, of course.
It's like it's just a metaphor.
It's a metaphor.
So the dad being worthless. But there's nothing more to say. It's just,
yeah.
You just can't leave your money to a lizard.
No.
But rich people kind of do that all the time. So for example, Bill Gates isn't leaving his fortune to his kids.
Mm-hmm. Which there's something to be said for that, I guess.
And then you have the flip side of that, which are the Trump kids, which are nothing but inherited money. And lots of hair pomade. I don't understand.
No.
Very strange.
Very greasy. Let's talk about, you know, the way mental illness is portrayed, because that's obviously the strength. And I think that's what John Green wanted to accomplish from the start.
You know, one of the things about this book is it's so autobiographical. And we talked about that a little bit last episode, right? Like, John Green suffers from OCD and anxiety, just like Aza. He's worried about microbes, just like Aza. So in a lot of ways, this book to me felt like John Green working through his own experience.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of the portrayal of mental illness?
Well, like I said before, I liked that Aza, we are so far deep in her head, and that is expressed on every single page. It's not necessarily in the words she says or in the conversation she has with people. In that regard, she's very much a stereotypical teenager who doesn't have a lot to say. But yeah. There's a lot going on upstairs. There were moments where the prose slipped into this kind of shocking stream of consciousness between Aza's rational mind and then this other voice that is very demanding and powerful. Those scenes were really hard to read. But I think that's exactly how we were supposed to feel when we read them. We're supposed to be in her head with her, seeing the fight that's literally going on. I thought it was pretty great. About as good as you could get in a young adult novel, for sure.
I think maybe as good as you can get in a novel, just period. And I have to admit, like, that's what it feels like for me. The way I experience anxiety is not nearly as strong. But a lot of it rang so true, especially that moment where you're like, this isn't reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, but what if it is? And one of the weird things about anxiety is its root is in something real, but the way your mind blows it up is not. So, you know, it is reasonable to be worried about having a cut on your finger and the cut getting infected. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's uncomfortable and you want to take care of yourself and all of that stuff. And so that's the cruel thing about anxiety is you can't just be like, this is totally untrue. It all kind of like hooks into something that is.
Right.
And so that felt very real to me. Her Googling also was very real to me because that's like one of my ineffective coping mechanisms mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. Is it's like, ooh, this thing scares me. If I learn about it, I'll be less scared about it. But really, I just end up like more scared about it. So
I think that happens to everybody. Like, that's just a 21st century problem. As soon as we have a fever, we're like, oh, shit, what could possibly be wrong with me? And if you pull up WebMD, you immediately have cancer or some other form of degenerative disease every single time. Right. So like, yeah, that's normal for almost anyone, let alone a person who's struggling with OCD or anxiety disorder. It's just ramped up.
Agreed. What is the weirdest thing you've ever WebMD'd?
Oh my gosh. That's too embarrassing to even say.
Fair enough.
I'm pretty sure I did. Yes. Okay. So I have a new house and I'm worried about radon in my house because I live apart.
Yeah, that's fair.
I know. So like I live in a part of the country where there have been some high levels of radon in people's homes. And so like yesterday I had a headache and I was like, I definitely have radon poisoning.
So, yes,
you know, like you get on Google and you find every single possible symptom of radon poisoning and you're like, oh yeah, I definitely have it.
Because it's like, are you tired? You're like, yes.
Yes, I am.
Do your eyes itch? Well, now they do.
Yes.
Do you have a headache? Yes.
Right.
You have radon poisoning and you're like, call Aaron Brockovich. It is time.
It's time. So yeah, like that is stuff that we do regularly. And so that was real to me in the book for sure, that Aza, every time she has a question, she's like, I've got to read a case study about C. diff.
Mm-hmm.
And she finds it immediately.
And it's not like she's learning new stuff about C. diff because she says, I've already read this. Like she's constantly just rehashing the stuff that she already knows in hopes that it makes her feel better. And she says, like, it made me feel better for like 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It's like her Band-Aid. It's just covering up the thing that's there. But the thing under it isn't going away.
Yeah.
From a personal standpoint and just from a literary standpoint, like I thought the portrayal was really good. I thought it was absolutely the strongest part mm-hmm. of the book. And it was overwhelming. And I think it's supposed to be.
Yes.
Like when she's in a thought spiral. But like, I think everyone experiences thought spirals. If you have a thought spiral, I don't think it means you have mental illness. Right.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to some level. Aces is obviously diagnosable and she needs therapy and help to manage it. But yeah, if we can even agree that, yes, we kind of understand where she's coming from. I think John Green has done a good job. Right. One of the things about these thought spirals, they get really philosophical, too. Like she's worried about the microbes, but she's also they lead her to bigger questions. Like, well, if my body is 50% bacteria that doesn't share my DNA, then like, who am I? What's my body? And she hates her body because it's almost like it's separate from her mind and it's separate from her as a person, like her identity. And those questions are really very, very complicated and hard.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a thing that he talked about before. You feel really helpless when you feel like you can't even control your own thoughts. Because so yes. many of us think about our thoughts as basically being who we are, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is pretty central to our spirit, our soul, whatever you want to call it. And if we can't even tell ourselves, like, this is not where my mind needs to go, then that's a really terrifying feeling. Because then you're like, well, am I in control of myself? Am I in control of my life? Like, who am I? What's happening? Mm-hmm. Like, that is desperate.
It's scary.
Mm-hmm.
It's what Westworld has done to me.
Has it?
Would I sleep with a robot?
Probably.
A robot that looks like James Marsden?
Mm-hmm.
Literally, my clothes would fly off my body so fast. It wouldn't even be a thing. And then I'm like, what does that say about me as a person?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, those are hard topics. And what I like about this book, what I like about John Green, is he knows he's writing for teenagers and he is unwilling to treat them like they're dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of YA books like spell everything out, like the writing's very utilitarian. And John Green just will not do that. And I think, you know, some people have trouble with the fact that his stuff tends to be very emotional, that borders on maybe overwrought sometimes, mm-hmm. that the characters sometimes don't feel like they have a lot of depth. I mean, whatever you want to say about that, you know, it's really important that John Green says, no, the teenage experience is as important and varied and impactful as anything that adults experience.
Those are very formative years. And no matter how different we are as adults, we're still shaped by those years. So, yeah, I agree. There's not compared to, say, Fault in Our Stars, which may have gotten more criticism for maybe being melodramatic. This book was definitely not melodramatic at all.
No.
If anything, it was a little bit heavy-handed, maybe for an adult audience, but I wouldn't even put that critique down. I think that was what John Green wanted to do with the story.
Agreed.
That was the effect he wanted to create, and he succeeded in it.
And that leads us to our most important thing to talk about.
Yes.
Star Wars fan fiction.
Which is the number one theme of the story, actually.
Yes. Is Chewbacca a person? I don't know.
Am I a person? That's the question.
I know. That's what made reading this book so hard, is you'd put it down and you'd be like, that is a really good question.
I'm actually just a bunch of microbes. That's all I am.
In a meat sack.
In a meat sack. Exactly. But no, the Star Wars part was really fun for me. You know, I'm a nerd. I enjoy it. And I'm not a fan fiction reader or writer, but that was a fun storyline that Daisy was actually a pretty successful fan fiction writer.
You've never written any fan fiction?
I have not.
Oh, man. When I was the stories I could tell you about middle school, I wrote Animorphs fan fiction in a notebook. There was this guy I had a crush on who also liked Animorphs, and he liked it.
What?
So I would pass the notebook to him, and he would read it the next chapter, and then I'd write the next chapter. Nothing ever came of it, but I was working that angle so hard.
That's awesome. Well, I don't even know what Animorphs is.
You don't?
I don't.
It's so... Let me tell you, it was a middle grade sci-fi series where these kids found an alien and then they got this power to turn into any animal that they touched because they needed to fight an alien invasion of these slugs that would enter people's ears and take over their brains. The slugs were called Yerks. Anyway, it was amazing.
That sounds fantastic. Did you keep copies of the things that you wrote?
Girl, yes. I have it somewhere at my mom's house.
Well, I am going to have to take back my answer because you talking about that makes me remember that I did write one masterful piece of fan fiction. I wrote the third installment of the Mighty Ducks, which there actually was a D3 movie that came out after I wrote.
I bet it wasn't as good.
Well, mine was called D3, The Last Quack.
That's amazing, Pixie.
But anyway, yeah, I did write that. But I think that's probably the closest I ever came to fan fiction.
To my credit, I haven't written any since like ninth grade in high school, but I was all in.
Well, tell me, do you feel like confessing something regarding Star Wars right now?
Oh, I mean, I've already said this novel I'm conflicted about, and then I confess that I don't like The Great Gatsby. I mean, are we even going to have any listeners if I tell this?
I mean, I don't know. I really don't.
I mean, I've never seen Star Wars. There. Boom. Mic drop. As a matter of fact, it has become sort of a point of pride to the point where I have demanded that my tombstone read, "Here lies Dr. Maria Blackheart, PhD. She never saw Star Wars."
I do love it that for all the time that I've known you, it really has been a bragging thing. Like, I've never seen Star Wars and I'm never going to.
Well, at this point, I'm like doubling down on it, yep. Right?
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, I did see the one with Hot Poe Dameron.
Oh.
With Oscar Isaacs.
Oh, Rogue One?
It was the other one with the girl with the seven buns in like a mohawk. I saw Rogue One too. It was written by monkeys from what I could tell.
Well, here's what I appreciate. You haven't seen Star Wars. That literally is like the touchstone for narrative for most people that we know. Like, everything they know about plot, character, climax, setting, like, it comes from Star Wars. And yet, you have a really pretty good understanding of all of those things without it. So, kudos to you.
I'm going to choose to take that as a compliment.
You should.
So, yeah, I don't know. On the upshot, I was never subjected to Jar Jar Binks outside of the ad campaigns.
That's right. Oh, he was a disaster.
And I understand the hotness of Harrison Ford from Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So that feels like a positive.
Definitely.
Like, I know enough about Star Wars that I'm not like, who's the guy with the black trash can on his head? Like, clearly I know who Darth Vader is.
Right.
But if anybody, like, when I was reading those sections, it might as well have been Greek.
I'm interested to see if this makes it into the cut, this whole section.
The chances of me cutting this are, like, incredibly high.
Anyway. So yeah.
Oh.
Daisy's a successful fan fiction writer, and that was a cute little part of her story. But also interesting for their, you know, friendship, and that Asa had no idea that she was actually, like, kind of good at this. And then turns out she actually had a part in the story. Wah, wah.
Yeah, and I thought that was maybe a little hard on Asa.
Certainly hard, yeah.
If my best friend wrote Star Wars fan fiction and was like, please read it, I'd be like, I love you. Write Animorph fan fiction.
And maybe I will.
For that. And Asa did other things. Like, she would watch the movies with Daisy all the time. Like, there are other ways to be friends with a person that isn't reading fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Anywho, so...
Do you have any closing thoughts on the book? I mean...
I guess my only closing thought is that I think this is an important book, like, mm-hmm. capital I important.
Yeah.
And the further I get away from it, I think the more I'm going to appreciate it for what it's done.
Same.
This is a book that I would not hesitate to recommend to anybody,
mm-hmm.
especially since I feel like mental illness is so stigmatized still. And it makes therapy not scary.
Right. Definitely.
That's my final thought. Do you have any?
Pretty much the same. As much as we've talked about some of the weaknesses of the book, I still enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. I learned from it. I do agree that John Green is a really good writer. And at times, if it felt heavy-handed to me, I don't really care. Like, I still got so much out of it that was okay. I do like reading and learning. So I applaud him for trying something that was probably very, very personally difficult and also mm-hmm. just creatively difficult. Like, he had a goal, which was to give us a glimpse into the mind that doesn't feel like it's in control of itself. And I think he did that.
And to be fair, I think he succeeds.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, you know, my feelings are complicated, partly because this book hits in a place that's, like, really emotionally raw mm-hmm. for me, especially in the fight where Daisy's like, it's exhausting being around you. You are a lot of work. This is very hard for me, too. And you're very self-centered. Those are fears that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Or reading Daisy say those things was hard. You know, and in this particular instance, like, feel free to take Pixie's word over my
No, it was a challenge. Like, it wasn't pleasant at times. And I don't have diagnosable mental illness. I have had therapy for other things. I went through some tough stuff in my life and definitely had some, like, situational anxiety and needed help with it. I hope that those sorts of things don't have the kind of stigma today that they might have at one time, because there are things that can be done to help us.
Yes.
And I hope that people come away at the very least from a book like this and realize that there are things we can do. We can take steps. The thought spirals, or whatever sort of spirals we're in, mm-hmm. we can work to get out of them. It doesn't mean that they're going to go away. I don't think we get the impression that AIDS is just, like, going to ever be cured. Life's just hard for a lot of people. And the best we can do is just figure out how to live with the hard things and find joy in spite of them and carry on and get better at dealing with them.
I agree. Hey, listen, there may be some of you out there that are listening to this episode that are having a hard time. We want you to know that there are places for you to go to get help. And so if you are struggling with anxiety or OCD or depression and you're having a crisis moment, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. They're there to help people with all sorts of problems. And their phone number is 800-273-TALK. TALK. You can also contact the National Alliance of Mental Health. They have a helpline. The number is 800-950-6264. And they also have a crisis text line. So you can text NAMI to 741-741 and someone will get in touch with you. Also, don't be afraid to get help. If you need help finding a mental health professional, Psychology Today has a wonderful list. You can type in your zip code and it will list all sorts of people who are nearby to where you live who can help you. You know, you don't have to be alone in this. You are not alone in this. And as John Green says, you know, your today is not your forever.
It's not.
So
I loved that line that the therapist would always say, which is, this is not uncommon. You know, it's not. And I did love that. She would throw that out there, but it's just not. Everybody has things. And so pretending they don't exist doesn't help. And acting as if you're alone, you don't have to feel that way because you are not. Even if your friends or your family or people that you hope will understand you don't, there are people who do.
And you know what? We care about you too.
Yes, we do.
There are people out there that care.
That's right.
End mushy segment. If you liked Turtles All the Way Down as a book, we have some really good recommendations for you.
Yeah. One of the books that came to mind, this is a very theoretical book. It's not fun.
Okay.
So if you are interested in metaphors and pain and how we talk about illness and pain or don't, Elaine Scarry wrote a book called The Body in Pain. It's a very dense, I don't recommend this for like light weekend reading, but if you're working on your dissertation and you're writing about bodies in pain, this is a good one. Fun fact, John Green did drop her name. And so I know for a fact that he's read her and knows some things about her theories regarding pain. And basically, you know, her argument is that pain may even be why metaphors were invented, because we needed a way to describe something that is so hard to describe.
I like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's called The Body in Pain by Elaine Scarry. And then another book that's at this point kind of a classic, Girl Interrupted by Susanna Kaysen. There's also a movie starring my girl Winona.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Girl Interrupted is a memoir based off of Susanna Kaysen's life when she was a teenager in the late 60s. She tried to commit suicide, was diagnosed with, I can't remember what she was diagnosed with, actually, but I think it was a personality disorder. And she wound up in kind of a mental institution for women. And so it's just kind of her story about how that was dealt with in the late 60s. Hopefully we've made some progress since then, but it's it's a thoughtful story. And she also has another book about her vagina.
Well, that was unexpected and also delightful.
Yes, called The Camera My Mother Made Me, which is just kind of talking about, wait, is that what it's called? I think so. Or The Camera My Mother Gave Me? But anyway, it's about she like starts having pain and some problems and no one can figure out what's wrong with her. So once again, it's just like about bodies and them being confusing and confounding and all the problems they cause us and the things that we go through in order to try to like feel well.
Can I just say that you have the best encyclopedic knowledge of books of anyone I know? Like that was an amazing like second option. So what? Impressed.
Good. I'm glad.
That's so funny. I have one recommendation.
Okay.
And that is Brain on Fire by Susanna Kahalen. And this is a memoir. When she was 24, she basically started going insane. She had just landed her dream job in New York. And then all of a sudden, like, her personality started changing. Like, she stopped being able to talk. She was having moments of paralysis and nobody knew what was going on. And so this book is part medical mystery and part insight into someone who is basically not in control of their own mind. It is a little bit scary, but it is crazy insightful. It's also ended up being a movie starring Chloe Grace Moretz, which I did not know till I Googled it.
Really?
So
I actually own that book and have not read it. It looks so good, though. Maybe I should bump it up good. In the queue.
I really liked it. All right. And so that means we get to announce January's book. Now, if you are reading Turtles All the Way Down at a later time and you want to talk to us about it, We are here to talk about this book probably forever. We are happy to chat with you, but it is time to move on.
Yeah, January 2018. I'm super excited because we're going to have our first guest on the podcast in January 2018. I know.
I'm nervous from a technical standpoint because every week is like, WTF am I doing?
Well, hopefully our listeners will just go with it and we'll figure out something. But yes, our January pick is Crooked House by Agatha Christie. So just a little bit of background on this choice. We haven't read a mystery, I guess.
We haven't.
Right? So this is kind of a new genre for us. Crooked House has a movie adaptation that I believe just came out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had actually kind of talked about Murder on the Orient Express or Crooked House. And then we consulted with our friends, Audrey and Emily, from The Year of Agatha, which is a fantastic blog. They have read every single Agatha Christie book and have many thoughts. And they're going to be our guests next month. So I asked them, I was like, which book should we read? And they collectively decided that we should read Crooked House.
I'm excited. I am going to have to brush up on my Agatha. I think I've read one Miss Marple mystery, so I am ready to get schooled.
There's a lot of knowledge that I need to gain as well, but that's why we're inviting our guests.
Before we humiliate ourselves.
They're literal experts. Like, they presented a paper in England this year about Agatha Christie.
I love it. And their Instagram is beautiful.
They have a fantastic Instagram. You can check them out at The Year of Agatha. And their blog is fantastic. Any book you want to read by Agatha Christie, they've covered it. I think that's pretty impressive. And I'm really excited to hear what they have to say. They're so much fun, by the way. Lots and lots of
fun. And now that we've said it out loud, it has to happen.
And in January, we will have another giveaway. Da-da-da! We're going to have another giveaway. I've got a copy of Crooked House for one of our amazing listeners to have so that you can read along with us.
Yay!
So, yeah.
We're ready to see you guys again in January after Christmas. You guys are going to be ready to go. You can ask for Crooked House from Santa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sure he's a huge Agatha Christie fan.
Sure. Or whomever gives you Christmas presents. We are equal opportunity holiday goers.
That's true.
This is America.
Yes.
Christmas, holiday, Hanukkah, whatever. We're here for all of it. So
Pizzamas. That's what the vlog brothers celebrate.
Festivus for the rest of us.
Oh, and you know we're at the end because we've lost it.
Yep.
So,
yep.
You know what? Actually, you know what we want for Christmas Hanukkah insert here? We would like you to subscribe and rate. That's what we want.
That'd be awesome. If you told a friend about us or if you upped our algorithm on iTunes, it's great. We'd love it.
Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram at Misfit Book Club, Twitter at Misfit Book Club, and you can email us at misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com.
We also have a Misfit Book Club Goodreads page, which is nice. Mm-hmm. And we have questions on our Instagram page, like discussion questions.
We do.
So either place, you can come answer some questions, get into good conversations with people. I'm really excited about conversations around this book. I can't wait to hear people's perspectives on it. So, yeah.
And our friends, our misfits, are so smart and so thoughtful. And, you know, at the end of 2017, which has been basically a dumpster fire, one of the bright spots has been all of you. So, thank you.
I agree. Thank you. This has been really, really fun. And I, you know, whatever your holidays look like, we're around. We're going to be on social media waiting to hear from you.
I'll be eating my feelings. Join me.
We'll be eating our feelings and hopefully hearing from you. So you guys are the best. I hope that 2018 is the best year yet for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't hear from you before then, Happy New Year.
Yes. Be safe out there, guys.
Bye.
Bye.